Hello, everyone. Today we are talking all things obsessive compulsive disorder, and we answer your questions on OCD and its relation to eating disorders.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode. I am Kat. I'm a registered psychologist.
And I'm Amy, a registered psychotherapist.
And we are your hosts of the Psychology Sisters. I realized we didn't say that.
I know. We just assume that, you know, people are aware. How has your week been? Tell me how you are traveling. What's been happening? Give me the 411.
Not much to report. I feel like it's Groundhog Day because we're in isolation and literally nothing has happened. It's not even anything exciting, I can tell you. Can't even make up anything excited. But it's been a strange week. I was just saying to you off mic, it's been one of those weeks where I just have no motivation to work. I just feel like I have no desire, no motivation, nothing to work. And then because I'm feeling like, because I'm behind in work at the moment, because I have no motivation, I'm so anxious because I'm so behind in work. So I'm stuck in this awkward place of don't want to do anything, but that's the thing that's making me anxious. So it's been a strange week for me this week.
Definitely. I always think of stress as being like two different types. You've got your productive stress when it like forces you to do things or makes you like super efficient. And then you've got your like debilitating stress where it's like, I just need to bury my head in the sand and I can't do anything.
It just makes it worse.
Get anxious and stress about everything that you're not doing, but you've got zero motivation to do it. So
it's been such a strange week. And I have my period this week, so everything's hurting.
Hormones.
And I'm just tired and I just don't do anything. So it's just been a weird week. What about you, my darling Amy? How's your second week of not holidays going?
Definitely not holidays. And I think that's another thing. It's like because you think, oh, I've got time off, which is a good thing. And these holidays definitely haven't been, like, don't get me wrong, it's been nice to not have the additional workload, but I've just had a stressful week. Same as you, it's been a bit strange in that I'm still at home, but I'm packing, you know, applying for new places to live. I've got my registration coming up. So just organizing that.
Andy's birthday.
And my partner's birthday. Just there's lots going on at the moment and it's been a little bit overwhelming, if I'm perfectly honest, but that's okay. I feel like I don't know how it's Friday already.
Where has
the week gone?
And you know what I was thinking? Even though you're not at work, because you are working from home at the moment, it makes it a bit harder to switch off from work when you can see your laptop or when you can, you know, you still have those associations with work. I know when I'm working from home and I see my office, even though it's the weekend, I still am thinking a little bit about work because we have that work environment at home.
Definitely. And we've been doing a lot with the Psychology Sisters this week as well. Like
we have,
you know, organized another article. We've done two episodes this week. So lots going on.
It's been a very overwhelming week for both of us. So it'd be nice to share this with the listeners because it's just a reminder that even we get so overwhelmed and anxious and it's not always sunshine and butterflies and happiness and zen. It's sometimes really stressful. So very relatable at the moment, I think, my darling Hudson. So this leads me on to your...
I was going to ask you first. I was thinking today you always ask me first what my pit and peak is and I wanted to ask you first.
Well, I think your pit is going to be very exciting to hear. That's why I want to ask you first, but I will certainly go first and leave the best till last. My pit this week is, as I said before, just feeling so anxious and so overwhelmed and just don't know what I'm doing this week. But my peak would be that I have just been watching so many Netflix series and I've just started watching Too Hot to Handle, which is so trashy, Amy, but it is
I've watched it already.
I knew you would have. So these are the highlights of my days in isolation is new TV series and finding the joy in isolation. So Amy, please tell me your pit and peak of the week.
Okay. So my peak is that I've moved past my pit.
Your nervous laughs when you're about you know, it's going to be good when Amy does her little nervous laugh.
Honestly, I have this uncanny ability to humiliate myself at the best of times. And this week, was a train wreck, to be completely honest. So I've been helping organize my boyfriend's surprise gift for his 30th birthday, which is coming up this weekend. And I've been so proud of myself and all of his friends because he had absolutely no idea. And I say had because past tense. I simultaneously destroyed two 30th surprise birthdays in a group chat. See, amongst all the chaos of moving, I had this thought pop in my head like, oh, I'll just make sure that all his friends know that the Zoom surprise reveal will be at 12 on Saturday. So while packing, I quickly got out my phone and I wrote like this message saying, you know, thanks everyone for contributing.
You piled some money together from everyone and you got him a really awesome gift.
Yes, correct.
And you wanted to reveal it to the group.
So the group includes all of Andy's close friends, all of them, every single one of Andy's close friends, quite a lot of people, to which I haven't met about 30% of these people. So they don't know me.
They're still in the phase of the relationship where you're still trying to impress all the friends. And
yeah. Anyway, so I send out to the group, just thanking everyone that Andy's surprise reveal will be at 12 on Saturday, blah, blah, blah. And then I get a message back from Andy saying, interesting, to which I was like, what? And then I look at the group and it was actually another group for his friend's surprise 30th. I was like, shit, now he knows. And everyone was like, ha, 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 this is so funny. Oh, my God, like you ruined everything. Ha, 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 ha. And I was like, oh.
So passive aggressive.
Oh, my God. And then I was like, okay, the only way to recover from this is to put on a brave face, laugh, like, ha, ha, I know, so funny. Like, I'm not crying on the inside. This is fine. So then I
sent it to
you.
Were you sitting there crying?
I was profusely sweating. Kat, there was sweat running down my arms from my armpits. I was just like, you know when your stomach drops and you are just like...
Yeah, that adrenaline. Yeah.
Oh my God, so much adrenaline. So then I sent to Andy's surprise chat a screenshot of the message saying, so this happened. And then someone commented, ha 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 ha, now you've ruined two surprises. Because the friend that was in the other group chat was in Andy's surprise chat. So then I had to quickly delete him from the group. Yeah, so then it kind of just snowballed from there.
Oh my God, Amy.
A lot of people that, again, haven't met, don't know me, were like, this is amazing. This has made my day.
It is amazing how you could single-handedly, in one swift action, do so much.
Yeah.
Look, at the end of the day, they should be so stoked that you are organizing surprise birthdays. So, and also you didn't reveal the actual gifts. I think that would be the worst surprise. If I got told what the gift was beforehand, that would be the worst. So all you've done is just clarify that there is a surprise gift for their birthday. I think that's fine.
It is fine now. At the time, things were not fine. I sent the two screenshots to a couple of my friends and I was like, I actually can't believe that I just did this.
You honestly were spiraling on. When did you send me Tuesday?
Oh my gosh.
Flailing. I honestly was flailing. I had to do a risk assessment.
Flailing in the kitchen. One of my friends rang me and she was like, are you okay? And I was actually crying on the floor of my kitchen. So just so you guys know, we all have these days where we do, you know, profoundly stupid things, and that's just part of being human. And everything
will
be fine.
We like to keep it real on this podcast. We like to keep it so real.
Just being raw and real, you know, these things happen and we move on. And like one of my friends said, it will be really funny after you get over the initial shock and the humiliation and the utter embarrassment from
I feel like this will be in your wedding speech. This will probably be a strong contender.
I'll never live this down. I will never live this down. All of Andy's friends now know me as the dumb one in the relationship. And that was referenced multiple times.
Absolutely not dumb. You're absolutely not dumb. A very simple mistake to make. You've been very stressed this week. You've been doing a lot. And it's a very easy mistake to make, but also equally so funny. Mm. I lost it when I got that message.
Yeah.
So, Ames, tell me your... at least give me a peek.
Okay, so my peek is that we have pretty much secured a new house.
Ooh, how exciting.
Application process, very exciting. I have actually never officially like moved in with a partner.
Oh, so I'm so excited for you. Nervous?
I am nervous, but it's like a good nervous. I think now that we have a place to move into, I'm excited. I think before, when I wasn't sure if we were going to find a place in time or what was happening, everything was a bit uncertain. I was worried, but now I'm excited. So it's all good.
Oh my God. I'm going to come over and decorate your house. I'm a newfound nester and it's my duty of care to come over with my Adairs catalog.
Brilliant. Cannot wait.
Oh, I've turned into someone that I hate. So moving on with the episode. Today we are talking all things OCD. Amy, tell me what you know about OCD.
Okay, so I think there's a common misconception with OCD, and I think that people often mistake those that are like meticulous with organization and people that like to be clean and plan out their week to every last detail, that that's what OCD is. And the actual disorder is actually really rare and can be quite debilitating. So, well, I know that OCD stands for obsessive compulsive disorder, and it's a serious psychological disorder that is frequently misunderstood by society and health professionals as well.
And media. And it's always exemplified in the media as this real cleanliness. Do you remember watching a Monk? Did you ever watch Monk on TV?
No, but I watched As Good As It Gets.
With
Nicholas. What's his name? Nick? Is it Nick?
Jack. Is it Jack?
Yes. Jack Nicholson in As Good As It Gets, he presented as someone having OCD symptoms, and it's like this obsession with checking things and walking in patterns, which are common traits. But I think there is this big misconception that society has around OCD, and like people posting on Instagram.
Oh, this grinds my gears.
Organization and cleanliness and then hashtagging OCD. That's not what OCD is.
No, and I think that's really important to watch our vernacular around our vocabulary and the language that we use, especially with any mental health illness. I know we always talk about this a lot, Ames, in our episodes about you watching your language around if you're not someone who is a sufferer, you shouldn't be saying that you are, because what that does is it really diminishes the meaning for someone who does suffer from it as well. And really, it's quite dismissive to say that. So if you are someone who's tidy, that does not mean you have OCD. It's quite a normal human behavior to be tidy and clean. And if you do like things a certain way, it does not mean you have OCD.
Yeah. Definitely.
The media is quite, it's all to do with cleanliness. Like it's all, everyone who has OCD is really clean. But actually, as you're saying, Ames, a lot of the OCD behaviors are more to do with the checking, you know, checking the locks, the touching. Most of the OCD, the compulsions are more to do with the checking rather than the actual cleanliness and the cleaning and the tidiness.
Yeah, because what it actually is it's experiencing unwanted or intrusive repeated thoughts, feelings, images, and sensations. And then the compulsion part is in a response from that. And that is when someone will try and alleviate the distress caused by having those intrusive thoughts. And the checking is, so say, for example, in that movie As Good As It Gets, he constantly checks that the door is locked, and that's just to make sure, you know, he might have that constant repeated intrusive thought of someone breaking into his house. So the compulsion is that constant checking to make sure the door's locked to ease the anxiety that something bad is going to happen.
Exactly. So the obsessions are the intrusive thoughts, the compulsions are the behavior that reduces the anxiety from the intrusive thoughts. And people with OCD do get trapped in that cycle of every time there is an intrusive thought, they do need to go ahead with that. It's almost ritualistic, that ritual of, you know, follow through with the compulsions or the behaviors in order to reduce that anxiety. And people with OCD believe that that's the only way they can reduce that anxiety. And also good to know here that whenever they do these compulsions, their anxiety is never going back down to zero and everything's fine. It does just reduce it a bit until the next time. So it's not like once they do it once, everything's fine and perfect and dandy. What it does is it reduces it a little bit. It'll build up again. They'll do their compulsion. The obsession will come back. And it's kind of like this real vicious cycle.
Yeah, compulsions can range with severity as well. So we said that it can be excessive cleaning or double checking to fastidious arrangement of objects or walking in predetermined patterns. And many compulsions are enacted because, you know, like we said, they believe that it will prevent something bad from happening, like checking a stove for potential gas explosions. Like I said, checking doors and windows to make sure that no one's going to break into their house, excessive washing and, you know, hygiene precautions to prevent contamination of possible spread of diseases. It's not just making sure that things are clean or things look organized. They are activities that come from pretty significant fear and responsibility to ensure that bad things don't happen.
Yeah. And it really just circles around safety. With OCD, there is that heightened anxiety. And so with any anxiety, we are searching for that safety. So I guess an obsession could be they might obsess that I didn't turn off the stove, or I didn't call my mum to check that she's okay, or I didn't check if I locked the door for the third or fourth time. That's coming from, I'm not safe here. I don't feel safe. And then the compulsions are the safety, they're the thing. Okay, if I do this, I feel a lot safer. It might be really illogical and irrational, but that is something that's decreasing their anxiety and making them feel safe.
Yeah. And I think what's really interesting about that is that so many individuals who suffer from OCD actually understand the relationship between their obsessions and compulsions quite well. A lot of people suffering with OCD think things like, if I just didn't have these thoughts, it would all be okay. But being unable to avoid these thoughts and actions despite being aware of the irrationality is part of the reason why OCD is so distressing. So OCD sufferers report feeling crazy for experiencing anxiety-based irrational thoughts, and finding it really difficult to control their compulsions is really distressing. So like I said, it does vary, and insight varies as well. So there are some people who have a lot of insight into their irrational thoughts, and there are others who insight is quite low, and they tend to believe that the thoughts that they're having are likely to be true.
Yeah. So I think, I guess for diagnosis, I mean, there is a difference, as we were saying before. I mean, just being tidy or just, checking things once or twice versus actually having with OCD. So you can have OCD traits and characteristics, but that doesn't mean that you're automatically diagnosed. And like we say all the time, please don't self-diagnose with OCD. But for the DSM-5, actually, to be diagnosed with OCD, you must meet the following criteria. So you must have the presence of obsessions, compulsions, or both. The obsessions or compulsions are time-consuming. So the DSM states that they must, you must be engaging in these compulsions for more than 1 hour a day, and they must be causing pretty significant distress or impairment in an individual's daily functioning. So functioning, we always talk about that in terms of your ability to work, your ability to socialize, your relationships, and things like that. So that's kind of what we mean by impairing your functioning. Also good to note here that in the previous DSM-4, OCD was actually under anxiety disorders, but now it's moved into its own category for OCD. So that doesn't mean that it doesn't have anxiety anymore. It's not related to anxiety. It's certainly still characterized by high anxiety. But what that means is that it's got its own category now, because it is quite different to just your general anxiety.
Definitely. I think that's a major improvement.
Yeah.
So we know that people with OCD tend to actually avoid people, places, and things that may trigger obsessions and compulsions. They also often have dysfunctional beliefs that can include a heightened sense of responsibility, intolerance of uncertainty, perfectionism, and that's important, like you were saying, Kat, with different personality traits. So people that are more prone to perfectionism can have traits of OCD or an exaggerated view of significant troubling thoughts. So I think that's important to include as well in how significantly it can impact someone's life or how debilitating it can be. And also, many individuals with OCD actually frequently have comorbidity with other anxiety disorders, such as generalized anxiety disorder or panic disorder. And I think, don't quote me on this, but I think it's over 50% of people that are diagnosed with major depressive disorder or bipolar disorder, and up to around 30% can be diagnosed with a tic disorder, according to the DSM-5. And those with OCD also tend to experience higher rates of body dysmorphic disorder and eating disorders too, which we'll go into later.
Yeah, absolutely. I think with eating disorders as well, they are commonly diagnosed together or misdiagnosed as the other one, because they certainly can express the same symptoms and behaviors, OCD, and especially something like anorexia as well. So as we were saying before, we just want to point out that we all do things when we're anxious to calm us down. So we all have certain strategies. You know, you might be someone who likes to check the door a few times, and that's completely normal. You might be someone who thinks, oh, did I turn off the stove? I better go back and check. Or, oh, I really am a little bit worried, especially now with COVID aims, that the hand washing will be increasing. Mm. If you are someone who is hand washing a lot, please know that that's a completely appropriate response and normal response to what's going on. It doesn't automatically mean you have OCD. It would be really interesting, Ames, after this, the effect of the prevalence of OCD following COVID, because this is certainly a very stressful time and there is that heightened anxiety around infection. So it'd be really interesting to watch those, you know, those rates after COVID has started to hopefully die down, hopefully reduce. So yeah, we just want to point out that everybody has those really natural ways to calm down and to check, and that's really normal. If it's impacting on your life though, I mean, if you're spending more than an hour each and every day, then that's when it might start to really slide into the diagnosable obsessive compulsive disorder.
I think one of the characteristics that's common with OCD that kind of describes what makes it a psychological disorder as opposed to just being really, you know, clean and organized is the thought action fusion. So for example, that's having a thought, say that you're worried about being a pedophile or that you're worried about killing someone, and thinking that because you've had the thought, the action is linked. So having a thought about an action is like doing the action. And this is often exhibited in those higher on the severity scale. And studies suggest that we find this characteristic more in some than others, again, relating back to personality traits. So thought action fusion is just another way in which appraising unwanted intrusive thoughts as meaningful not only increases distress and feelings of responsibility, but it also increases the urge to neutralize and suppress the unwanted thought. So this can actually be one thing that's really successfully addressed in CBT therapy or CBT treatment, because people learn to recognize the irrationality of thought action fusion and respond to an irrational thought. For example, you could think, if I go out onto the road, I'm going to cause an accident. And then we can kind of replace that with a more rational evidence-based thought, like, well, I've had this thought quite a few times, and every time I go out onto the road, there hasn't been an accident. Like, this has never happened. So yeah, I think that's important to point out, is that it's not just having the thoughts, it's the belief that having the thoughts means something bad is going to happen.
Yeah, or it's just as bad as actually doing the thing. As humans, thoughts pop into our head that are extremely illogical. And because we perceive them as wrong, we're actually more likely to think of them. That's reverse psychology for you. So we might have these random thoughts that pop into our head of murdering your partner. And while you think that would probably never happen, people with OCD or have that really, that thought action fusion, they think, I've had this really terrible thought and this means that I'm actually going to harm them and I'm really scared of harming them. I actually don't want to do it. So usually people who have these thoughts, or another one, a really classic example, Ames, is when you look at your partner and you think, oh, I don't think they look very handsome, or I don't think they look very good today. And then you think, oh my God, does this mean that I don't like them? Does this mean that I'm not attracted? And does this mean I'm falling out of love with them? So those thoughts are really quite debilitating. And please note those thoughts are quite normal. It's very normal to have those thoughts. Not all the time, but you know, we do have thoughts that do pop into our head that we think, oh, that was a weird thought to have. Why did I think that? Generally because we're not allowed to think those thoughts, so we're more likely to think about them. But people who do suffer from OCD, they see these thoughts as really, really awful and really bad. And that's because they're actually quite empathic and sensitive, and they're quite worried that they think that they're a bad person, when actually it's probably the opposite. They're probably having that reaction because they're actually a really good person and then quite empathetic and quite sensitive to their thoughts. They're just worried that something bad will happen. So the thought action fusion, it is really really, really handy to talk about in treatment, especially with CBT and especially with any therapy, Ames, because a really concerning part of thought action fusion is that suppression. Oh my God, I'm never going to think about it again. I don't want to have that thought again. And, you know, anything to the reverse psychology, the more you say, oh, I don't want to think about it, I'm not going to think about it, the more we're going to think about it. So
yeah, definitely.
Talking about it in therapy, the first part and the best part is just talking about it. That means you're not suppressing it anymore. That means you're getting it normalized. You're having it validated. And that can be extremely, extremely helpful first step of treating OCD.
Definitely. Understanding intrusive thoughts and thoughts that pop into your head that you don't really have control over. That's a different type of thought.
Mm.
Like you said, so for example, if we say close your eyes and don't think about a blue hippo, chances are you're going to think about a blue hippo. An image of a blue hippo is going to pop into your head and you're going to be thinking, why can't I stop thinking about this stupid blue hippo?
Yeah.
So we have, you know, it's like when someone walks down the street and they have a funny hat, you might automatically have this thought that pops into your head, like, that's a weird hat. And you don't have a lot of control over that. But I think therapy is really good at teaching people, especially OCD, that you might not necessarily be able to control the thoughts that you have, but you can control what you do with those thoughts. So you can control what that thought means to you. Like, you know, we might keep thinking, I wonder why that person chose to wear that hat. You know, why would they pick out that hat to wear? Like, did they really think that walking out of the house with that hat was a good choice?
Mm.
And then you might be thinking, why the hell am I thinking about this person's stupid hat? So you get to decide, you know, is the hat the person chose to wear important to you? Like, what does it mean to you? And therapy can, I guess, to some level be really, really good at teaching you to control the importance of the intrusive thoughts. And, you know, for things like, what if something happens to my family? Or what if I run over someone when I'm driving? You can kind of come back to that. Well, it's kind of like the blue hippo. How disturbing would it be for you if you viewed them as the same importance level as a blue hippo? It wouldn't really be disturbing. And it's like a difficult concept to grasp, you know, especially because they're two different things and it can seem quite flippant. But we know that the more time we spend trying not to have those thoughts, the more we're going to think of them. So the core concept is that sufferers with OCD can't control what thoughts pop into their head, but they can learn what to do with those thoughts.
Absolutely. And I think also, people with OCD who have those really intrusive thoughts, they tend to actually be connected to their deepest, darkest fears. So if you have those intrusive thoughts of those, you know, my partner's going to die, that's actually because that's probably a big fear that you have. It doesn't mean that the more you think about it, I think people with OCD think the more that they think about it, the more that it'll actually happen. And that's actually mostly not true, because just because you're thinking about it doesn't automatically mean that it's going to happen. But people with OCD, they worry about that because it is these intrusive thoughts tend to be quite based around their fears. And it doesn't mean that they're a bad person or that anything bad's going to happen. It just means they're actually, that's their thoughts and their fears kind of coming to the surface a little bit and manifesting in a way that's an intrusive thought.
Mm.
So yeah, thought action fusion, that's really, really helpful to learn via. I know we had a question about this, Ames, in our inbox about thought action fusion, and it's just about a little bit almost like unhooking your intrusive thoughts and understanding that you're not a bad person and it doesn't mean that this event will come true. It just means that you maybe are suppressing it and you're not thinking about it in a way that's helpful. That's why it keeps coming back. So treatment is so, so helpful for this as well. I do want to talk about there's another type of OCD, Ames. I don't know if you've heard of this, but it's called purely obsessional thought. So it's just pure OCD. Have you heard
of
that?
Pure OCD, yeah.
So with the most common type of OCD, we have the obsessions, we have the compulsions. So with just pure OCD, it's just the obsessions. So the compulsions happen mentally. The compulsions happen in our heads. So, you know, people with pure OCD, pure obsessions will just do something in their head until their anxiety decreases. And pure OCD often goes undiagnosed or misdiagnosed just as anxiety. So people with pure obsessions. So just like the thought action fusion we'll talk about before, the mental intrusions and obsessions they have are quite ego dystonic, meaning that they're quite dark. So that might be thoughts about harming yourself, thoughts about, you know, really uncommon sexual activities such as pedophilia or incest, persistent doubt about your own sexual orientation, persistent doubt about your romantic partner, kind of what we're saying before, having thoughts about religion, thoughts about your somatic functions such as blinking, swallowing, breathing. So these things are something that someone who has pure obsession thinks about consistently and thinks about, and those intrusive thoughts really enter their mind, and they believe that they're a bad person for thinking about these thoughts as well. So for example, as we're saying before about the pretty enough thing, you might be a newly married couple and, you know, the husband might be sitting across from the wife, and the husband might glance at his wife and think, oh, she doesn't look very good today. So what happened is, for someone with pure obsessional thoughts, they think, oh my gosh, why did I have that thought? That's not really good. I shouldn't be having that thought. I'm only newly married. I should love my wife. Maybe I shouldn't be marrying her. Maybe I shouldn't even have kids with her. Am I a bad person? So you can see how these really obsessional thoughts, I mean, this is common in OCD and pure obsession, but they really can spiral and snowball out of control. And it really does go back to that person thinking that they're a bad person and really misinterpreting their thoughts and thinking that it's not normal to have those thoughts. So mental compulsion. So as we said, in OCD, we do have the behavioral compulsion. So that's more the checking, the washing, the cleaning, the counting. But in pure obsessional disorder, we do have the mental compulsion. So they're a function of, they function really as a method of figuring out the meaning of thoughts, and they serve as a desperate attempt to reduce any anxiety and distress. So people who have pure obsessional compulsive disorder are very sensitive to uncertainty, and they perform these mental compulsions as a way of allowing them to feel safe. This generally backfires because then these thoughts are treated as if they're valuable and they're correct, and therefore they become stronger. And this is essentially really important to why therapy is really helpful for OCD. And this can lead to quite a vicious cycle, as we're saying before, of those really intrusive thoughts and those neutralizations that actually build in intensity and frequency. Generally, OCD untreated, it does tend to get worse because people do spiral and really get caught up in those obsessive thoughts, so much so that they might withdraw completely from work, from social life, from doing anything because they're so fearful of what they might do, or they're so fearful that if they don't do these certain compulsions that something will go wrong. So I guess some ways that people, I guess that OCD perpetuates and keeps it going. So there's something called mental reassurance, and this is kind of how people provide reassurance to themselves that these feared consequences will not occur, or that they don't mean anything. So someone with OCD might examine whether having thoughts of harming others means that they're bad, or that they actually want to harm that person. And I think that if it's left untreated, people with these mental reassurance will try and reassure themselves that they're not a bad person. But then when another thought pops up, it really perpetuates the idea of, oh, I am a bad person. See, I had another thought. So it's really, really, really hard to treat OCD on your own. You'd really do. We really recommend having a therapist as well. So people with OCD are quite sensitive to their intrusive thoughts, and they generally start to misinterpret those thoughts and almost personalize the thoughts as if it means that they're a bad person. So there's lots of ways that people with OCD it does perpetuate, and it does often go untreated. And I feel like people with OCD are quite embarrassed, or they're quite ashamed of, they're quite aware of their OCD, as you're saying, Ames, they have so much insight. So they won't get help because they are embarrassed, or they think that they're being silly, or they think that they're evil. I think that they're a bad person. And I think that's quite dangerous to get caught up in that. Oh, I don't want to get help, I'm embarrassed, or I don't want to talk about it, I'm embarrassed, because that actually makes it worse by not talking about it.
Definitely. There is a lot of guilt and shame associated with OCD, especially for those that have higher levels of insight. OCD has also often been referred to as the doubting disease. So people with OCD often claim that when they're checking or systematically ordering objects in their environment, that they'll need to continue doing this because things don't feel quite right. They often have this feeling that if they don't keep checking, something feels like it's missing or not right. So this doubting feeling that appears to drive their ritualistic compulsions needs to be completed fully and properly. And that's when we see things like constantly checking that things are locked, things are closed, things are turned off. I actually have a pretty close relationship with my mechanic. And he has a colleague that is OCD. And he will say things like, I get messages from him at night saying, I can't remember if I remembered to do this, or I can't quite remember if I did this. Can I go back to the shop and double check that I've done that, just so I know it's done? Ironically, rather than a memory deficit causing the repeated checking, it's repeatedly checking that appears to cause the doubts in memory. So the more that someone checks, the less confident they'll be whether they've actually done it correctly or, you know, whether they've turned something off or done something properly. And this creates a really vicious cycle of doubting and then needing to ensue checking.
Mm.
So that's something else that OCD sufferers often struggle with, is that constant doubting. Did I turn that off? Mm. Did I make sure that was locked? Have I done this right? And then if I haven't, something bad's going to happen.
Mm. There's a lot of self-doubt and a lot of a lack of confidence with OCD. And often it can also develop after something bad has happened. So for example, if you have gotten broken into, you're more likely to think, you know, it's quite normal to be quite vigilant to the locks, you know, in your house for the next few weeks, but it can actually develop into, you know, OCD, because you've had that bad experience, you felt unsafe if someone's broken into your home. So it can actually develop after, you know, I see lots of clients who it develops after something has actually happened, because they're, you know, thinking, oh, it's going to happen again. I need to make sure I check it, because I want my safety. I want to make sure that I feel safe. But actually, ironically, it's actually making them feel sometimes more unsafe.
Yeah, definitely. OCD can be traced to the beginnings of either a stressful life event or a significant change, such as a new job, the birth of a child, or even puberty. Mm. And the development stems from that, I guess, inflated responsibility that generates anxiety and then that drive to ensure that they don't let themselves or others down by allowing something bad or dangerous to happen.
Or that they have control over a situation. It can just be as simple as feeling like you need control over a situation. And that's a really simple, that ritual of the compulsions can be a really simple way to feel like you've regained control, even though ironically, it might actually make you feel the other way sometimes. So short term, it might make you feel like you've regained a bit of control, but I guess in the long term, it can actually make you feel more out of control if you're checking more constantly and losing that confidence in yourself.
Mm, definitely. So what are the other causes of OCD?
So I guess, I mean, we always talk about nature versus nurture. So it does certainly have a genetic component. OCD, it's actually not as well studied as, you know, something like anxiety or personality disorders, but there is certainly studies have found that there is that genetic component. I think if your mother or father had it, you have a 25% increased chance of having OCD. It doesn't mean you'll automatically get it. It just means you have a higher risk. It also, you know, environmental factors, as we spoke about AIMS, you know, having those stressful life events that can certainly trigger, you know, those OCD tendencies and could even develop into, you know, having the disorder. There has been a bit of a breakthrough in the research in the last 5 years, because it's been quite a understudied disorder. And I think moving it from the DSM, from the anxiety disorders, to having its own category has meant that there's been a lot more focus on OCD. So I guess talking about where it comes from, some researchers think that they have pinpointed the part of the brain and the genes associated with OCD. So there was a meta-analysis. So this was, I think, in 2018, 2019. I can pop the study in the show notes if people are interested. There was a meta-analysis of about 500 adults and children who had OCD across the world. And researchers found that the part of the brain called I'm going to butcher this, I always do with parts of the brain, it's called cingulo opercular network of the brain. I'm really sorry if anyone who's a brain expert is listening to that. So what that is, it's a network of the brain, which is a collection, it's linked by almost called highways of nerve connections, and it's deep in the center of the brain. So this area of the brain normally acts as a monitor for errors, or it helps people to stop an action. So if you're running and you see a snake, this is the area that lights up when you know that you need to stop running or you need to jump over the snake. So this is really where a lot of your decision, your fast action decision making comes into it. So the results from this meta-analysis found that in OCD, the brain responds too much to errors. So it's highly sensitive to searching out errors, but it does not know when to stop. So it doesn't have as much of the doesn't have the stop signals so much as what other people would have. So in the study, they asked participants who suffer from OCD and also those who don't. So they had a control group of people who don't show any OCD characteristics to not respond to errors. So they were shown visuals of things that had errors and they weren't allowed to correct it. That would drive anyone crazy, I think. And they had to stop themselves from taking an action to fix the problem. So a consistent pattern emerged where, compared with healthy volunteers, people with OCD had way more activity in the specific brain areas involved in recognizing the errors, but less activity in areas that could not help them to stop. So they weren't able to stop as much. So the researchers kind of described it as their foot is on the brake, but they're not able to stop the car. So they're more likely to act on when they see an error, when they feel that something's a little bit off. Also, there is, going back to the, there's a protein in your body, and UK scientists have, this is only just fresh research. So UK scientists, this was in 2019, I think, have reported that they have discovered patients suffering from OCD have increased levels of a protein called immunomodulin, also called IMUD, in their lymphocytes. So they say that this protein presents a lot more in mice who show OCD characteristics. While it hasn't been studied in humans at the moment, they do generally do a lot of mice studies to work out, you know, what parts of the brain are involved in certain mental health disorders. So eye mood is something that is found to be a lot increased in mice who do show those OCD behaviors. So when the researchers treated the mice with this certain antibody, and I think they're in the process of researching this antibody for humans, this actually neutralized the eye mood and the levels of anxiety and OCD behaviors reduced. So that's pretty exciting. I know a neuro nerd like me gets excited about the new research. So they found that a certain protein and certain part of the brain associated with OCD. But because this is only new studies, they do need to do a little bit more to confirm, but at least it's something that is being studied a lot more at the moment.
Yeah, definitely. Love getting down and nerdy with some neuroscience.
Holistic statistics, Ames, we're bringing it back.
So yeah, we know that there are neurobiological predispositions and environmental factors that cause the intrusive thoughts and compulsive behavior patterns that we see with OCD. And we know that there are several factors that are thought to be responsible for the development of OCD. Primarily, scientists hypothesize that it progresses due to a psychological and biological components, like a blend of the two, and that such abnormalities of hormone levels that are associated with mood function, genetic mutations, infections, and possible brain injuries lead to the cause of OCD. So we also know that, like Kat was saying, areas of the brain, I won't name them all, but areas of the brain or regions of the brain that are involved are those of social behavior, complex cognitive planning, voluntary movement, and emotional and motivational responses. So that's like Kat's explaining, your foot's on the brake, but you're not stopping. The other aspect is, like I was saying, hormone levels, serotonin in particular, the neurotransmitter that communicates between brain structures and helps regulate vital processes such as mood, aggression, impulse control, sleep, appetite, temperature, and pain. Studies that involve twins show, I guess, the link between having lower levels of serotonin and OCD, so the development of the disorder. And we know that in terms of trauma, those who experience physical or sexual abuse or other traumatic events are associated with a greater risk factor of developing OCD or OCD symptoms as well.
Yeah, wonderful. So let's talk about treatment. So as we talked about diagnosis, we read out the criteria, but as we said, please go, if you are someone who's a little bit worried about your OCD or if you think you are showing some tendencies, please go and seek therapy. And it will take a bit of time because it is quite a complex disorder. You do need to sit with a therapist for quite a while to discuss your OCD. Sometimes people don't want to be diagnosed. That's completely okay. It can be really validating for some people, but can be quite harmful. So that is something that you can talk to your therapist about as well. And I think also for, you know, treatment, you do need to see someone for your personalized strategies and tools, because what works for one person with OCD is not going to work for the next person, because everyone has a different type of OCD and different thoughts and different compulsions. So really important.
And as we mentioned, there's higher comorbidity with OCD. So, you know, your therapist might be working on a range of different symptoms with you that aren't going to be the same from person to person.
Exactly, exactly. Even if someone has the exact same obsessions, the exact same compulsions, it can be manifested really differently with treatment options as well. So just be really mindful of, if you are someone who's a little bit worried about this, what what you read on the internet, what might work for one person may not work for you. So that's why we are strongly encouraging with OCD that you do seek treatment for it. Undiagnosed, it can certainly become a lot more severe and debilitating and really impact on someone's life quite significantly. So addressing the thought, so let's talk about CBT. So I think that's one of the primary treatment factors, methods. Definitely. For OCD, because OCD, it does have those irrational thoughts, what CBT does is start to challenge and maybe introduce some more realistic thoughts. So addressing that thought action fusion, as we're talking before, is a real key component of many cognitive behavioral treatments for OCD. Although the imagined link between your thoughts and actions or the obsessions and compulsions is almost always illogical, if you have OCD, it can actually be so difficult to have the insight into the irrationality of these thoughts. So in your mind, you might actually think, oh, I think this is, you know, I'm doing this right. It's making me feel a little bit better. So it must be correct. It must be true. So therapy does focus on challenging that link between your obsessions and compulsions through experiments and observations. So one way might be exposure therapy. I know we spoke about this in our social anxiety podcast. So it may seem weird, but this way of confronting your fears directly will lead to a lot fewer and less intense fears or obsession about, so for example, germs. So your brain learns through exposure therapy that nothing bad happens when you stop performing these compulsive rituals. You'd probably feel upset if, say, for example, you were someone who checked the stove a lot. You'd probably feel upset when you first didn't check the stove for your normal 10 times a day if you only checked it 9 times. You might even feel a little bit panicked. But your body and brain has a wonderful, wonderful adaptation system called habituation. And what that is that eventually you will start, your anxiety will lessen the less you do something. It'll get used to doing less. So it depends on what your compulsions are. And eventually your anxiety will eventually lessen through habituation. It's kind of like when you jump into a pool of cold water. When you jump in, the water might feel freezing at first, but after a while you do, your body gets used to the cold and you habituate to it and you feel okay. So that's really similar to OCD. Therapists will not ever throw you in the deep end with OCD. If you're someone who's concerned about germs, they're not going to go and make you, I don't know, touch all the germs at once. It is a very graded exposure to your fears and it is always done with support, but that is certainly one way that's quite effective.
Yeah, definitely. It gradually desensitizes sufferers from OCD, their anxiety to a specific type of thoughts, things, or situations, and it leads to obsessions and compulsions. You know, you kind of learn not to engage in those habitual compulsions by gradually reducing the anxiety prompted from your obsessions or thoughts that you would have encountering different triggers. So you just basically learn to better manage OCD symptoms by becoming desensitized to those triggers.
And adapting. And I think people with OCD forget that we are very adaptive creatures and we do habituate. It can seem really scary because by completing your compulsions, that's keeping you safe, what you perceive as safe.
Definitely.
But we need to, it's really good to address this in therapy as well, that by not doing it as well can also keep you safe.
Definitely. Another thing that CBT is really, really effective for is targeting the inflated levels of responsibility that a lot of people suffering from OCD feel, because it attempts to reduce those feelings of responsibility, and that results in really significant gains, like alleviating that feeling of being responsible for something bad happening to self or others is really, really powerful. And again, that's achieved through kind of challenging those irrational thoughts and replacing them with more evidence-based, realistic ones.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what we need to do, and it was really important in therapy, is fighting those compulsions. So building space between your obsessions and your compulsions, because when you tend to have these obsessive, intrusive thoughts, we tend to complete the compulsion straight after to try and get rid of that anxiety. So what I think would be really helpful for people to do is to build the time between when their obsession occurs and when their compulsion occurs. So we generally have that really automatic, oh my God, I'm feeling so anxious, I need to do my compulsion to feel better. The more space we build between that time, like the more time we have to feel a bit uncomfortable and a bit yuck, the more likely we are to reduce those compulsions. So what we're teaching our body is that actually it's okay this uncomfortable feeling, I can make it go away on my own. I don't need to do the compulsion. And to make it go away on your own or to do it less means that you need to practice your relaxation strategies. Your body is highly anxious. And with any time we feel anxious, we need to calm our nervous system right down. So if you do get that obsessive, intrusive thought, we need to stop. We need to try and have as much time as we can before we complete the compulsion. You're still able to do the compulsion. You're never going to go cold turkey. But I think making sure you're doing your breathing, making sure you're calming your body and your nervous system down, whatever your relaxation strategies are, they might be going for a walk, they might be eating, they might be listening to music, they might be calling your mum or dad, anything, like whatever works. I think that's when you start to build the strength. It will be really uncomfortable, but if you can sit with that uncomfortability and awkwardness, the less awkward and uncomfortable it feels over the long term. And that's when you see growth. And that's when you start to see that, oh, actually, this isn't so unsafe. Oh, actually, I could go for 2 minutes without doing my compulsion. Oh, I could go for 5 minutes. Or, you know, and eventually the frequency of your OCD does start to reduce. But you need to be comfortable with sitting in the uncomfortableness of that feeling.
Definitely. Effective treatment of OCD can include medication as well, which increases serotonin in the brain by limiting its reabsorption by brain cells. So they're called serotonin reuptake inhibitors, SRIs, or selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, SSRIs. And they can actually take as long as 12 weeks to produce an improvement in symptoms when used to treat OCD, which is why, as we've said, it's super, super important to have psychological intervention as part of your treatment as well, because everybody does respond to medication differently and it can take a little while. So having that professional support, whether it's mindfulness-based CBT or another type of CBT, as Kat said, whatever works for you, that can really assist in not only monitoring symptoms and how medication progresses and your feelings during the initial stages of treatment, but the blend of two can be really, really effective in, you know, managing the hormonal side, the serotonin reuptake inhibitors, and then giving you practical tools for alleviating everyday anxiety that may trigger your OCD symptoms, and then challenging those intrusive thoughts as well. So the blend really does give you a great combination for treating the obsessions and compulsions, and then looking at the actual neuropsychological side as well.
Yeah. So having the multifaceted approach, the multidimensional approach of the pharmacological and the therapy side of things can be extremely, extremely helpful for OCD sufferers.
Let's go into our Q&A. So we actually had a week or so ago, someone asked us a question relating to OCD. So we thought we would save it for this episode. And that question was, how does OCD relate to eating disorders?
Well, they can present quite similarly. I guess you don't really think of OCD being related to eating disorders, and the relationship between the two has actually gone quite relatively unstudied and often misdiagnosed. So the behaviors that result from both OCD and eating disorders may appear extremely similar. It just might be difficult to determine which of the two disorders the patient actually has if they're both present at the same time. And that's actually quite common, that if someone who does have an eating disorder, they might also be diagnosable with OCD as well. And then it's just a question of which one brought on the other one. Which came first, the chicken or the egg? And I think that's something that really needs to be worked through in therapy as well.
Definitely. It can be a real challenge for clinician to recognize whether it's a particular form of OCD or is it separate, or, is it OCD and an eating disorder, or is it merely an obsessive compulsive quality to that person?
It can be extremely complex. That's why I said before, you need to allow a lot of time for OCD. Mm. It's not something you can just magically cure in 6 weeks, because it does present, as you know, we're saying here, with eating disorders. It can present with anxiety. It can present with depression. It can present in personality disorders. So really need to take the time with OCD to really understand where these thoughts are coming from and whether there is a dual diagnosis with something else as well, and that comorbidity with other diagnoses.
Definitely, definitely. So an individual that is struggling with an eating disorder and obsessive compulsive disorder may choose foods based on color, weight, shape, for example, and they might, you know, have obsessions about a different food group and over-exercising. Eating disorders are characterized by behaviors similar to OCD in that way, such as obsessive thoughts about food, calories, food rituals, such as checking, cutting foods into different shapes, organizing foods on a plate, or hoarding food items. So there is definitely a connectedness between the two.
Yeah. Say, for example, with anorexia or bulimia or any eating disorder where the person's cognitive belief is that they are not good enough or they need to lose weight, you know, you might be checking your measurements, you might be checking your weight, you might be obsessively checking whether you, if you ate that one thing, how much weight you gained after it or how much weight you have lost. So there is that real checking with the numbers as well. Having OCD and an eating would make your eating disorder a lot more complex because both are really in, I guess, wanting some control. And I think that's really the undercurrent of a lot of anxiety disorders. It's the undercurrent of OCD and a lot of eating disorders. It is not all the time, but it's wanting that control over a situation. So I think it would be addressing that control and talking to that person about what their fears are, I guess, what control they think they have, what their negative beliefs about their body are, addressing those intrusive thoughts. People who have anorexia or not eating properly are more likely to think about food. You know, when you're hungry and all you can think about is eating food, that can manifest into an intrusive thought with someone who has an eating disorder, like, oh, I'm really hungry, but I don't want to eat, or I'm really hungry, that means I must be fat. You know, having those real thought action fusions as well. Oh, my stomach's rumbling, I'm hungry, I'm an idiot, or I'm going to get fat. So the more, and they might have that thought, the more I think about food, the fatter I'm going to get. So you can see how it sounds really irrational to us, but for them, it's that real trying, that desperate grasp for control and understanding, you know, the link between their obsessions and compulsions as well. So it's really, really tricky with eating disorders. It just adds another complexity to the mix, but very common.
Definitely. And I think another similarity that they both have is they both significantly interfere a lot with work, social lives, school if you're studying, to the point where it does cause significant distress. Because I know with eating disorders, social life is something that is dramatically impacted upon, and it's similar with OCD. And like you're saying, Kat, it does come, you know, back to control over, you know, fear of not being able to control those thoughts and compulsive behaviors, and possibly losing control if they're triggered in certain environments.
Yeah, a really good thing to bring up about treatment is recognizing the triggers. So, what is something that triggers these obsessions and these intrusive thoughts? I mean, think about when does it start? When do you notice it the most? When don't you notice them? When don't you notice getting triggered? But when do you? So for a lot of people, a change in environment can mean that their triggers are changed. So do you experience this on holiday? Do you experience this when you're at work? Really, really understanding those triggers, and especially for eating disorders, when do you feel the most triggered? Is it when you're alone in front of the mirror? Is it when no one else is home and it means that you can eat without judgment? Is it shopping for bathers? Is it at the beach? I mean, really understanding your triggers can really help with OCD.
Especially understanding the cause, like how did that become a trigger? Was it after something traumatic experienced, or, you know, did it come from a significantly distressing event? And then I feel like understanding cause is always key in someone's therapeutic process because that aids in allowing an irrational thought to become rationalized. Okay, well, I have this irrational thought because X, Y, Z. And understanding that, I feel, alleviates a lot of frustration and confusion around why do I have these thoughts and trying to control them. Understanding is a really key factor in that. Understanding the cause.
It's not easy suffering from OCD. But if you are listening to this and you're thinking, oh, I don't really know, it sounds like a bit like me, but I'm not sure, please, we urge you to go and seek support from a therapist. Please don't diagnose. Or if you're someone who is very tidy, please don't diagnose yourself with OCD. It can be really debilitating and damaging to someone who does actually suffer from OCD. So really watch your vocabulary around OCD. It grinds my gears. Amy, you know how much it grinds my gears when someone says they have OCD, or they put it up on Instagram or something saying that they tidied their house and now they must have OCD. Also pantry. People who organize their pantry, they always just
I was just going to say, OCD. What? If you've organized your pantry, It's not characteristic of OCD.
It's actually quite, it can be a way to calm people. I mean, people might actually feel calm when they clean. I know I do. What that means is that you like to have a tidy house, and that's okay.
And it's quite normal to want to live in a clean environment.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So just be really, really mindful of that, because there are people who might be suffering from OCD who maybe don't say anything or are too embarrassed. And if you say something like that, it can make them feel even worse as well. So just be really mindful of the vernacular around OCD, OCD disorder. Wonderful. Well, guys, there is so much we could talk about with OCD. I feel like we've just scratched the surface. There's lots of different types of OCD. And we hope that you guys enjoyed this episode. And we may have a special guest next episode.
Yeah.
Because May is Mental Health Month. And we thought we wanted to maybe start interviewing some people or bring on a special episode for the Mental Health Awareness Month.
Now that we've figured out this whole Zoom remote recording.
We say that now, but like, let's just touch wood and
hope it adding a third person into the mix could be troublesome. Yeah.
Also, I'm sorry to anyone about the editing with Zoom. It's a little bit tricky to edit with Zoom, so I apologize for the tacky sound sometimes.
No,
but I promise when this is all over, we can go back to normal. All right, guys, we will see you next episode.
Bye.
Bye. Thanks so much for tuning in to today's episode. If you want to see more, please follow us on Instagram at The Psychology Sisters. To make sure that you never miss another episode, please hit the subscribe button in the podcast app. If you know someone who might enjoy this episode, we would love you to share this with them. Please note the content shared in this episode is purely educational and does not replace personalized advice from a mental health professional. See you next week for more spicy science and sexy self-help.